welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud. And we want to remind you to please continue listening, learning, reading these documents with us so that you can be more empowered in what you do, what you say, especially if you're getting on your knees and making an appeal to heaven. Learn, pray, and act. So the other two obligatories that I want to combine into one is that the whole focus, our focus as citizens of the United States, needs to be very concise and succinct. It's all about compliance to the Constitution, that the U.S. Constitution must be complied to. Therefore, as we move forward, we need to make sure that our petitions, our campaigns, and holding our public servants at the local level, as well as all the way up, the messages every public servant under oath must comply to and fulfill their oath of office. This brings me to my final obligatory, because I want to start saying this on a more regular basis. I am looking for people who want to become electors for the President of the United States in 2028. To restore the Electoral College back to the people so that the parties no longer determine the outcome. Therefore, what we want to do is we want to get you to actually go and start working with your state Secretary of State so that you can actually get them to understand you have a right to be on the ballot as the elector, and technically, the state does not have the authority to print the names of presidential candidates. They are supposed to print the names of the electors. We're not to have a popular vote. And so what we want to do is we want to get down this path of helping everybody understand that the way we've been choosing the president has been all unconstitutional. Now, what we're doing is we're actually looking at the Madison's notes on the convention, and we're still dealing with, if I remember correctly, we're dealing with admitted states into the union. And so let me kind of go up at the, it's basically this whole thing that we left off with has been covering the admission of states into the union. So we're picking up at the beginning of Thursday, August 30th, and they're just reconvening, and Governor Morris it says right here, Article 7, resumed for a question on it as amended by Mr. Governor Morris's substitutes. Now, Mr. Carroll goes ahead and basically wants to make some changes, so let's go ahead with that. Go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Carroll moved to strike out so much of the article as requires the consent of the state to its being divided. He was aware that the object of this prerequisite might be to prevent domestic disturbances, but such was our situation with regard to the Crown lands and the sentiments of Maryland on that subject that he perceived we should again be at sea if no guard was provided for that right of the United States to be back to the backlands. He suggested that it might be proper to provide that nothing in the Constitution should affect the right of the U.S. to land ceded by the Great Britain in the Treaty of Peace, and proposed a commitment to a member of each state. He assured the House that this was a point of a most serious nature. It was desirable above all things that the act of the convention might be agreed to unanimously, but should this point be disregarded, he believed that all risks would be run by a considerable minority sooner than give their concurrence.
Okay, so then Mr. Morris seconded the motion to move it forward. And so Mr. Rutledge made a point of contention or a point of information.
Mr. Rutledge is to be supposed that the states are to be cut up without their own consent. The case of Vermont will probably be particularly provided for. There could be no room to fear that Virginia or North Carolina would call on the United States to maintain their government over the mountains.
Okay, so what he's basically saying is that Vermont, there may be that case where that would maybe provided for, but in Virginia and Carolina, where they're looking to actually extend themselves further west instead of creating a new state. That's what he's saying. So Mr. Williamson said
that North Carolina was well disposed to give up her western lands, but attempts at compulsion was not the policy of the U.S. He was for doing nothing in the Constitution in the present case and for leaving the whole matter in status quo.
Right. In other words, he's basically laying out, Mr. Williamson is laying out this concept that the federal government shouldn't tell a state that they can or can't do something, that they have to do this or they can't do that. So the whole point was admitting states into the union. That's where they wanted to go, to kind of leave it up to the state to, if Virginia wanted to continue extending itself, but if if the people of the said territory that's going to become a state or be added to that state and let that state's boundaries grow, that those people in that area would be amenable to being brought into that state. Like when we look at Kentucky, or when we look at New Hampshire, because the reason this is in play is because states already had extended themselves to where they had these territories, but it wasn't a part of their formal state boundary. And they had kind of created a makeshift boundary. And actually, Thomas Jefferson did this. Actually, Thomas Jefferson's father, who was a surveyor for, I think, the crown, was going around and surveying the current states as they were, so that, you know, in disputes between England, because they were part of England, they were part of the British Commonwealth. And so if the French and or the Spaniards wanted to start disputing, they say, hey, come on, we've affirmed our land to be from here to here, from here to there, and so forth and so on, and that these areas are territories. And so as they started doing that, and actually Thomas Jefferson started actually trying to create a mechanism of how states would be created, that they wouldn't be so big, they would be smaller. But nevertheless, as we look at these new states or these territories, determining whether they become a part of the state or whether they become a new state would be left to the people of the territory.
Right.
Okay. So what ended up happening is the territories chose to become a new state so they could have a breakaway from whatever. They just wanted to have control over their own self-destiny. Okay? Mm-hmm. So Mr. Yeah. Wilson then pipes up.
Mr. Wilson was against the commitment. Unanimity was of great importance, but not to be purchased by the majorities, yielding to the minority.
So that's unanimity.
Unanimity, yeah.
Right, okay.
He should have no objection to leaving the case of new states as heretofore. He knew of nothing that would give greater or juster alarm than the doctrine that a political society is to be torn asunder without its own consent. On Mr. Carroll's motion for commitment.
Okay, so then they move forward, there. Right? They move forward to see if they would be able to do that, and it failed. So Mr. Sherman then moved to postpone the substitute of that article agreed to yesterday in order to take up the following amendment. Quote, the legislature shall have the power to admit other states into the union. So when he says the legislature, who is he talking about?
Congress.
That's right. Remember, they were using the legislature for Congress. So the legislature shall have the power to admit other states into the union and new states to be formed by the division or junction of states now in the union with the consent of the legislature of such states. Parentheses, the first part was meant for the case of Vermont to secure its admission, because that way New Hampshire would then basically have to agree as a state legislature to let them become their own state. In other words, they wanted to make sure that the states still had a dog in the fight of what their original designs were, because Vermont was technically a territory next to them that they kind of expanded into. The question is, now Vermont is looking to become its own state called Vermont. Vermont was the first state to join the Union after the Constitution. So, and they did it actually pretty quickly. So if I look at the state legislator statehood order, and I just kind of, let me pull up the spreadsheet on this. And so the original order, when Vermont joined the Union, Vermont was in the Union March 4th, 1791. So what happened in 1789 or 90, somewhere in there, Congress wrote an enabling act, and I believe I have a copy of that. But Congress basically sent out an enabling act to basically determine whether the state legislature of New Hampshire was okay with creating the second state, Vermont, or this new state, Vermont. And when the state legislature allowed Vermont to join the Union as an independent state, then Vermont basically received an enabling act from Congress of where they would go to convene and create their constitution, create their state government, and then be admitted into the Union, because they needed to do both. They needed to form the state government, and they needed to basically create their own constitution. What became a usual thing, the federal government, because they had the bright... So, when the Constitution was ratified, who do you think got selected from the elections of Congress into the federal government? Who do you think got selected? Do you think the best and the brightest, or the dunces and the stupid idiots and, you know, the maniacal people, they got elected to go in there? Now, most people would say the maniacal people, you know, the conspiracy people. But actually, the best and the brightest were the ones that the people were sending to Congress. So Congress holding this wealth of domain knowledge and being the smarter guys, because they were just, you know, they'd been around longer and more seasoned. That's what Congress was. And so they started helping with the noblest of intent, started helping the new states. Well, what ended up happening was the new people coming into Congress after the first 10 years, because many of these men were very old. I mean, Roger Sherman both signed the Declaration of Independence. He signed the Articles of Association. He signed the Articles of Confederation. And he also signed the Constitutional, the U.S. Constitution. And he was at the ratification debates in Connecticut. Now, they didn't really debate. They just ratified, because they were a small state and they rubber stamped it, because they knew that their sovereignty was protected. So bottom line, Roger Sherman didn't live much longer, but he was a sage and a very wise old man. So when we look at the first season, the first session of Congress, I'm just going down a rat hole, but I want to make this kind of quick, because this is important. When Madison was debating with Roger Sherman on how to put amendments, how to amend the Constitution, that process, do we just list the amendments at the end, or do we integrate them into the language as intended by the amendment? Madison wanted to do the latter, integrate them based on the amendment itself, the intent of the amendment, to change these specific words. Roger Sherman didn't want that. He wanted actually to have it as a separate, you know, item. And so it was the Amendment 1, Amendment 2, Amendment 3, Amendment 4, instead of being integrated into the specific article that was being changed, like the 17th Amendment changed Article 1, Section 3. So as we look at this debate, Roger Sherman had a lot of respect by the men on that committee because they were all men. And James Madison was the kid. He was the young one. I mean, he was literally a kid when he was working with Mason in the 1783 or 84 Virginia Constitutional Convention, where James Mason was, or is it George Mason? I think it's George. George Mason, yeah, it's George. George Mason was creating the Bill of Rights for the state of Virginia. Madison was just a kid. I mean, he had just recently, within the past 10 years or so, I mean, if you look him up, he graduated from Princeton in the 1770s, I think. I mean, so he was just a kid compared to Mason. And so a lot of these older men, they just had a reputation that they knew what they were doing, and they got more latitude or more credibility. Madison was right in the committee on how to amend the Constitution, because it has only become problematic because we have amendments that change the language. And when people read the Constitution, because it didn't change the language, most people don't know to go and actually read the amendment that actually changed that, because they don't even know that it was changed.
Mm-hmm.
So unless there's an insert, because if you want to have a really dead or a bad constitution, you'll have a constitution that doesn't highlight words, at least to say, hey, why are these words highlighted? The little note that says these words were changed by this amendment. At least something to do that. But they didn't do that at all. They just put the amendments at the end. That's it. And so when you read, actually, because I did this with John Rowland's color-coded constitution, he put in brackets, the italicized words were changed by an amendment. And I thought that, well, why is he doing that? Well, because they made the conscious decision not to change those words. And when you read it, if you're reading it and you don't know that those words were changed, then you don't consider going and looking for an amendment. So that's what I'm saying. It became very problematic. And going through this every time we talk about the Bill of Rights and those types of things, you know, I think helps people understand why we have some of the problems we have, because people do not understand, you know, how to read the Constitution and look for those changes and so forth. Because if you're working with a Constitution that is not marked, that identifies what parts have been changed by a constitutional amendment, you're flying blind. Those people fly blind. I've ran into people all the time that literally worked with the basic language without any highlights or anything else. They would create classes. I knew this guy in Oregon that created classes on the Constitution based on that hard language of the Constitution, even though it was amended. He didn't know that. And he created basically course material that misled people.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see the danger in what ended up happening. And I don't think it was Roger Sherman's intent to try to mislead anybody, but he just thought of the simplicity of doing it. Anyway, right, wrong, or indifferent. Let's keep going. Move to postpone.
Dr. Johnson.
Yeah, yep. So on the question, it was passed in the negative. In other words, it didn't pass. So now Doc Johnson wanted to insert new words. Go ahead.
So Dr. Johnson moved to insert the words hereafter formed or after the word shall be in the substitute for Article 17, the more clearly to save Vermont as being already formed into a state from a dependence on the consent of New York to her admission. The motion was agreed to. Delaware and Massachusetts?
Maryland.
Only dissenting. Maryland only dissenting.
Okay, so my bad. I keep on saying New Hampshire, but Vermont was actually an extension of New York. And if I remember correctly, Pennsylvania was the state that extended into Ohio and further west. But anyway, okay, so on this question, it was basically 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So it passed. So on basically what Governor Morris recommended, that actually passed. Now, Mr. Martin, keep going, wanted to do something else. So anyway, go ahead.
Mr. Martin urged the unreasonableness of forcing and guaranteeing the people of Virginia beyond the mountains, the western people of North Carolina and of Georgia, and the people of Maine to continue under the states now governing them without the consent of those states to their separation. Even if they should become the majority of counties, as in Virginia, may still hold fast the dominion over them. Again, the majority may place the seat of government entirely among themselves and for their own conveniency, and still keep the injured parts of the states in subjection, under the guarantee of the general government against domestic violence. He wished Mr. Wilson had thought a little sooner of the value of political bodies.
Uh-huh.
In the beginning, when the rights of the small states were in question, they were phantoms, ideal beings. Now, when the great states were to be affected, the political societies were of a sacred nature. He repeated and enlarged on the unreasonableness of requiring the small states to guarantee the western claims of the large ones. It was said yesterday by Mr. Governor Morris that if the large states were to be split to pieces without their consent, the representatives here would take their leave. If the small states are to be required to guarantee them in this manner, it will be found that the representatives of other states will, with equal firmness, take their leave of the Constitution on the table.
Okay, so one of the things that is being brought up here, and again, this is Luther Martin, and one of the things that I like what he did, as he basically points out in what I would say as the second, is it the second sentence? I think so. Where he says, even if they should become the majority of counties, as in Virginia, may still hold fast the dominion over them. Again, the majority may place the seat of government entirely among themselves and for their own conveniency, and still keep the injured parts of the state in subjection, or in other words, under them, under their control. In other words, not allow Kentucky to be. So what he's doing, and the reason I'm pointing this out, is because they talked about the power of the counties. Do you see this?
Mm-hmm.
It says, even if this new place may become a majority of the people, the majority of the counties, as in Virginia, may still hold fast dominion over them. So in other words, Virginia, in its makeup as a republic, the counties actually carried the political weight of Virginia. Do you see that?
Yeah, I did notice that. I caught that.
Okay. So the point is, because when I go through these things, I'm looking for these types of things. I'm looking for this insight that actually supports the concept of the counties being the base politic of the state.
Mm-hmm.
And here we actually have it. So what I have to do is I actually need to make a comment. So why don't you talk about the weather while I write here? forgive me, counties as base politic of state. And this is going to be
basically saying that the counties wouldn't allow them to do that.
Yeah, so we're running into a break. So perfect timing. I should have just noticed and said, hey, during the break, I'll try to make this note. But folks, as we go through these things, these other little things that help give us evidence in proving how important the counties are, we're highlighting those. So anyway, you're witnessing through history some of these important details. We'll be right back after this. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so Mr. Martin makes this comment, right? And so he goes through, and it was said yesterday that if the large states were to be split to pieces without their consent, the representatives here would take leave. If the small states were be required to guarantee them in this manner, it will be found that the representative of other states will, with equal firmness, take the leave of the Constitution on the table. So, in other words, he's pointing out that because we have these two different paradigms of small states and big states, they're going to interpret this type of language to either be suitable for securing their state sovereignty or not. And so now Mr. Martin, after saying this, right, Mr. Martin said that. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then Mr. Martin then says again, so I'm questioning, was there some change of the speaker, because there's a notation that Mr. Martin said this and then Mr. Martin said something else. Does that make sense? In other words, did Mr. Madison, in writing his notes, just not combine the two comments or what? I think that there's this little part that came from Madison that was not stated. In other words, this little dash, it was said yesterday by Mr. Governor Morris. So I think that that was actually Governor Morris speaking on what was said.
Oh, yeah.
Does that make sense?
Uh-huh.
Okay. So I'm going to have to add that to that little part. And that way there's a break between what Mr. Martin said, then Mr. Governor Morris said the day before this. Now, Mr. Right. Martin, okay, so let's go ahead and see what Mr. Martin then says.
Mr. Martin moved to postpone the substituted article in order to take up the following. The legislature of the United States shall have power to erect new states within as well as without the territory claimed by the several states or either of them, and admit the same into the Union, provided that nothing in this Constitution shall be construed to affect the claim of the U.S. to vacant land ceded to them by the late Treaty of Peace, which passed in the negative.
Okay. So, in other words, it didn't go through. They didn't want to do this. So, now they changed it again on the question to agree to Mr. Governor Morris's substituted article as amended in the words following, quote, new states may be admitted by the legislature into the Union, but no new state shall be hereafter formed or erected within the jurisdiction of any of the present states without the consent of the legislature of such state, as well as the general legislature, in other words, Congress. And let me see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So it did pass. Now,
you need the approval of the Congress and the state legislature.
And the state legislature, correct. Okay. So now, Mr. Dickinson, now I find it interesting that when they talked about new states within erected within the jurisdiction of the present states. So the question is if it's a territory, is that under the jurisdiction, because it's a territory of Virginia, Kentucky's a territory, so the Virginia state legislature had to secede. In other words, New York was going to have to secede to allow Vermont to become Vermont. Basically, that's what they're saying. So Mr. Dickinson, he moved to add the following clause to the last, and he says, go ahead and quote that.
Nor shall any state be formed by the junction of two or more states or parts thereof without the consent of the legislatures of such states as well as of the legislature of the United States, which was agreed to without account of the votes.
Okay, there you go. So Mr. Carroll then moved.
Move to add, provided nevertheless that nothing in this Constitution shall be construed to affect the claim of the United States to vacant land ceded to them by the Treaty of Peace. This, he said, might be understood as relating to lands not claimed by any particular states, but he had in view also some of the claims of particular states.
Okay, so Mr. Wilson then was against that motion, right? There was nothing in the Constitution affecting one way or the other of the claims of the U.S., and it was best to insert nothing, leaving everything on that litigated subject in status quo. Okay, so Mr. Madison then, I think, says something that might be relevant. Let's see. Go ahead.
Mr. Madison considered the claim of the U.S. as, in fact, favored by the jurisdiction of the judicial power of the U.S. over controversies to which they would be parties. He thought it best, on the whole, to be silent on the subject. He did not view the proviso of Mr. Carroll as dangerous, but to make it neutral and fair, it ought to go farther and declare that the claims of particular states also should not be affected.
Ah, okay. So, in other words, this is kind of important. And as a matter of fact, when you read Article 4, Section 3 of the Constitution, this is what it says at the very end of the second paragraph. It basically says, nothing in this Constitution shall be so construed as to prejudice any claims of the United States or of any particular state. In other words, as a new state was coming forward and there may have been claims to that land, there's nothing in here that basically says that this new state or that old, that the existing state couldn't have claims against that and say, hey, you need our permission to make that a state because we've got claims. So they're just trying to make sure that it wasn't just non-prejudicing the federal government. It was ensuring that legitimate claims would stand, whether they be by the federal or by the state, if they were legitimate claims. Now, I'll also say that when a new state is formed, it, in its act of becoming a state, takes full claims over every inch of land that it is being admitted into the union as a state. Does that make sense? Because there's later on, the federal government starts actually creating these claims in the Enabling Act to say, we're going, because this territory is a federal territory, and that territory is to become a full sovereign state. So when it becomes a full sovereign state, every inch of that land becomes under the jurisdiction and cognizance of that independent and sovereign state. Right. The federal government has no claims within the Constitution to be able, there's nowhere in here that allows them to stake any claims once that state becomes a state. Because the very beginning part of the second paragraph says this: the Congress shall have the power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or other property belonging to the United States. So once that state becomes a state, it is no longer a territory, nor is it property belonging to the United States. So this is important because when you go to Article 1, Section 8, and it's subparagraph 16, where it talks about the property that the federal government can possess, there's nowhere in here where they can possess territory as permanent United States property. Territories are to either be traded amongst another nation to obtain an advantage or some other lands that we have interest in. So in other words, you can go out and buy, you know, this has happened throughout history. A nation would understand, hey, you know, I think that this is going to be really important to China. So we're going to go out into the Pacific and claim these islands, and we're going to make those ours. And then we'll keep China from being able to make claim to those. And that happens all the time. So in this particular case, when we look at the territories of the United States, they don't have the authority to possess carte blanche territories unlimited time. Because what they list here is they have the authority to possess the District of Columbia. They have the authority for possessing land for the purposes of the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and needful buildings. There is no territory, forest, reservation, wetland, or any form of conservation, nothing. In other words, the territory is ancillary when you look at Article 4, Section 3. It starts with this because this is the whole purpose of the territory. Section 3 states that new states may be admitted by the Congress into this union. In other words, as new states are to be admitted into this union, they will have the ability to regulate territories to get them to the point of becoming a state. That's why territories is ancillary to the admission of sovereign states. So when we go through the ratification debates, it will be clarified that the federal government is not to become rich with land. They are to be very limited, and this is why they were limited to the seat of government and to those needful military strategic pieces of land and needful buildings, and that's it. The only reason a territory becomes of any value is so that they can trade that territory. Let's say we wanted an area that was a part of Mexico that would go across our southern border, which is actually what was happening. And let's say the United States went out and made a claim that would have become very beneficial for Mexico, but we now stake claim for it, and Mexico comes along and says, you know what, we'd kind of like to have that land, and go, you know what, we'll trade you. We'll trade you this land for that land. And actually that did happen with Great Britain when we pursued and went after Washington State and the Pacific Northwest. Because Britain claimed all of that. Go ahead.
What do we do about all the land that the government has claimed as theirs?
You have to prove, it's really easy, where in the Constitution do you have the authority to claim any land within a state that is not for the erection of a fort or the erection of a magazine or the erection of a dockyard, arsenal, or needful buildings? Those are the enumerations. When we get into the ratification debates, we'll actually be able to provide the clarity in the Virginia ratification debates as to how they're not supposed to be rich with land. They're supposed to be very constrained to only have those things necessary for them to perform the functions that they have been given in the Constitution, if that makes sense.
So who is the one who goes to them and says, where in the Constitution do you have authority? Is it our state representatives? Is it our federal representatives?
So it would go to the states, and then all of the states would basically, because this goes down the process of republic review. When the federal government basically makes claims, and this actually goes down to what Madison stated in the Virginia or the notes, or the report on the Virginia resolutions and his notes on nullification, that when the federal government starts assuming and taking land that they don't have the authority to take, then the state actually has the right to ultra interpose and basically kick the federal government out and say, you have no authority to, you know, to even claim this. You don't even have the authority to pull us into court over these claims, because these claims do not arise under the Constitution. Where in
So then all the people who say we need to go to court, they don't need to go to court. They can just
correct. As a matter of fact,
you don't have this authority. We're taking our land back.
Correct. Everybody needs to learn this concept that when the federal court or when the federal government says, well, we're taking you to court. Well, hold on here. You have to show us that this arises under the Constitution, because it doesn't arise under the Constitution. You have no jurisdiction for your court to review this. Does that make sense?
100%. So,
right. I think so many times, Tammy, people have been dragged into court and they've never claimed jurisdiction and never actually asserted to the court, you don't have jurisdiction over this. I don't have to be here. This is tyranny. You're arresting me with powers that you don't have. There's nothing delegated to you in regards to your possessing this land. You can't possess it. It's ours. So when the state actually stands up and says, you can't possess these parcels of land, this is not in the Constitution. These are assumed powers under these assumed roles, responsibilities, and properties that you've claimed that we've never delegated to you. Therefore, you can't have these things. Now, the states all need to start standing up, because there's many states that are being directly affected. They're all being directly affected in different ways. The way they're going after the different parcels of land and so forth is problematic. Does that make sense? Because each state, you know, it's like snowflakes. The federal government has jumped into these situations with each state differently.
Yeah, because about 48% of Wyoming's lands are federally, technically, supposedly federally owned.
Yes, right. And technically and constitutionally, they don't own any of it.
Right.
Right. Absolutely. So we actually have, I have an article regarding the jurisdiction, the constitutional legal jurisdiction of the federal government regarding property and land. And we also have a couple of petitions that I go through this and identify this, that with the Department of Interior, the petition for the Department of Interior and the petition for the ability to identify the ability for a foreign entity to come into the United States to buy a asset, resource, whatever it is, and whoever it is, it doesn't matter whether it's a person, a business, or a nation. They have no constitutional authority to allow a transaction to occur where the title, the ownership, is transferred to a foreign entity. Anything that's within that state is state property. And the states are even constrained from making that same kind of contract or transaction with a foreign entity to allow a foreign entity to come in and buy any asset, resource, land, what have you, within that state. Mm. So that's in Petition 21. And the Department of Interior, I'm going to say that's probably Petition, 11, 12, something like that. Anyway, yeah. So we got 9 minutes, so let's just kind of keep going, and we can move Mr. on Sherman. With Mr. Sherman. There, go ahead.
Mr. Sherman thought the proviso harmless, especially with the addition suggested by Mr. Madison in favor of the claims of particular states. Mr. Baldwin did not wish any undue advantage to be given to Georgia. He thought the... Is that how you say that? How do you say proviso?
What's that?
How do you say that word? Proviso?
Proviso, yeah. Okay. I thought you were talking about the positivist.
Okay.
Positetist or detist?
No.
Okay.
Proviso. He thought the proviso proper with the addition proposed, It should be remembered that if Georgia has gained much by the cession in the Treaty of Peace, she was in danger during the war of... Yeah, that one. I don't know what that one means.
Yeah, the posititis. So proviso is provision. It's a legal it's a legal term for provision. And that right there, uti posititis, whatever, that's Latin for something else. So Mr. Baldwin was obviously a lawyer. Okay. Right. Okay.
So Mr. Rutledge thought it wrong to insert a proviso where there was nothing which it could restrain or on which it could operate.
There we go.
Mr. Carroll withdrew his motion and moved the following. Nothing in this Constitution shall be construed to alert the claims of the U.S. or of the individual states to the Western Territory, while all such claims shall be examined into and decided upon by the Supreme Court of the United States.
Okay.
Mr. Governor Morris moved to postpone this in order to take up the following.
See, it's kind of interesting. They're moving forward, then hold on, we need to postpone and do this. It's amazing everybody's keeping... Somebody's keeping track there. Keep going.
The legislature shall have power to dispose of and make all needed rules and regulations respecting the territory or other property belonging to the United States, and nothing in this Constitution contained shall so be construed as to prejudice any claims either of the U.S. or of any particular state. The postponement... It must have failed.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Mr. Martin moved to amend the proposition of Mr. Governor Morris by adding that all such claims may be examined into and decided upon by the Supreme Court of the United States.
Right. Okay.
Mr. Governor Morris, this is unnecessary as all suits to which the United States are parties are already to be decided by the Supreme Court.
Okay.
And Mr. Martin, it is proper in order to remove all doubts on this point.
Okay, so then they voted on it, and it failed. Okay, so the motion of Governor Morris, of Governor Morris was then agreed to, with Maryland being the only dissenting voice. All right, so that kind of wraps up that part. And let me see here, as we kind of click down and down and down, I'm trying to find where do we jump into the next one. And I think it's a ways down, because regarding the Constitutional Convention, here we go. So this is blue, so it's obviously of a different concept or thought. This is where they talk about the Constitutional Convention being added into Article 5. So let's go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Jerry?
Yes, Mr. Gary, right.
Okay. Mr. Gary. Mr. Gary moved to reconsider which article is that?
That would be 19.
19. Okay. He moved to reconsider Article 19 on the application of the legislatures of 2/3 of the states in the Union. For an amendment of this Constitution, the legislature of the United States shall call a convention for that purpose. This Constitution, he said, is to be paramount to the state constitutions. It follows, hence, from this article that 2/3 of the states may obtain a convention, majority of which can bind the Union to innovations that may subvert the state constitutions altogether. He asked whether this was a situation proper to be run into.
Uh-huh. Okay, so Mr. Hamilton seconded the motion. So what we're looking at is this Congress, the legislature of the Congress, shall call for a convention for the purpose, obviously, see August 6th, and I think that's where they were talking about the convention for amending the Constitution. This Constitution, he said, is to be paramount to the state constitutions. It follows hence from the article that 2/3 of the states may obtain a convention, a majority of which can bind the Union to innovations that may subvert the Constitution altogether. Remember, this is what's being argued by the anti-conventionites, right? Because if they call a convention, they can literally change everything and rewrite the entire Constitution. That's what he's saying. Okay, so Mr. Hamilton seconded the motion. Go ahead.
Mr. Hamilton, but he said with a different view from Mr. Gary, he did not object to the consequence stated by Mr. Gary. There was no greater evil in subjecting the people of the U.S. to the major voice than the people of a particular state. It had been wished by many and was much to have been desired that an easier mode for introducing amendments had been provided by the Articles of Confederation. It was equally desirable now that an easy mode should be established for supplying defects which will probably appear in the new system. The mode proposed was not adequate. The state legislatures will not apply for alterations, but with a view to increase their own powers. The national legislature will be the first to perceive and will be most sensible to the necessity of amendments and ought also to be empowered whenever two-thirds of each branch should concur to call a convention. There could be no danger in giving this power, as the people would finally decide in the case.
Okay, so Mr. Madison speaks up and says, on the vagueness of the terms, call a convention for the purpose, close quote, as sufficient reason for reconsidering the article. How was a convention to be formed? By what rule decide? What the force of its acts? Okay, so in other words, he's basically laying out, well, hold on here. You know, how is this, you know, convention, how is it going to be ruled, or are there constraints or anything like that? And so on the motion of Mr. Gary to reconsider, it was 1-2, so it was divided. I don't know, New Hampshire was divided. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. So 9 states went ahead and basically said, let's reconsider this. Okay, so Mr. Sherman moved to add. So this is where they're changing the language of Article 5. So go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Sherman moved to add to the article, or the legislature may propose amendments to the several states for their approbation, but no amendments shall be binding until consented to by the several states.
Right, by 3/4. So that's what we know actually comes into Article 5. That it requires 3/4 of each state. So go ahead. Mr. Gary seconded the motion. Mr. Wilson then moved to insert 2/3 before the words several states, on which the amendment to the motion of Mr. Sherman, let me see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So it did not carry. So Mr. Wilson then moved to insert 3/4 thereof, or 3/4 of, before the several states, which was agreed to without contest, without any problems. So we're running out of time, so we're going to stop right here, and then we'll pick up the con part again tomorrow when we get back together, because this is important, the way they kind of laid this down. And so, as Madison pointed out, you know, hey, what are the parameters? Is this really an open thing or what? So we'll dive into that. As we do, we are basically telling you that we're reclaiming the Republic and we need your help. God bless. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.